Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Robert Bounds. Now, in 1939, the novelist Raymond Chandler published The Big Sleep, his first novel, introducing his much-loved sleuth, Philip Marlowe. Marlowe was the proto-noir detective, a trench coat-wearing, gruff, wise-cracking, hard-drinking flatfoot with an eye on the kind of blondes that would make a bishop kick in a stained glass window. Marlowe was played by Robert Mitchum on the big screen, and he was perfect, which gives you an idea of the vibe. Chandler wrote 9 Philip Marlowe novels and a handful of short stories, but the Marlowe legacy has been continued by other authors. Most recently, Lawrence Osborne in the new novel Only to Sleep, and it's that which we're talking about today. Osborne's novels The Forgiven, The Ballad of a Small Player, Hunters in the Dark and Beautiful Animals have been hugely critically acclaimed, but how will he fare taking on someone else's character? To discuss today, I'll be joined in the studio by Katie Law, Deputy Literary Editor at the London Evening Standard, and John Mitchinson, publisher and co-founder of Unbound. It's 1988 and Philip Marlowe is 72 and living out his retirement in California when he's paid a visit by 2 guys from an insurance company. They want him to investigate the case of Donald Zinn, a rich man who supposedly drowned off his yacht and has left a young wife behind with his fortune. But is Zinn really dead? Well, as our 2 visitors know, there's only one man to find out, and they lure him out of retirement for one last job. Katie and John, welcome to the programme. We talked before we switched the microphones on a lot about how much we enjoyed this book. So we're in familiar territory here with the novels of Lawrence Osborne and, of course, the novels of Raymond Chandler. Katie, I'll start with you. Do we think this is an Osborne novel or a Chandler novel?
Well, that's a brilliant question, actually, because the answer is...
Because the answer is impossible.
The answer is that it's really a Lawrence Osborne novel, I think, and he has synthesized lots of good things about Chandler, and he has really inhabited the voice of Chandler and channeled him, but to his own ends. And I am a latecomer to Lawrence Osborne, and I think he's one of the most exciting novelists around at the moment, and I am waiting for him to absolutely skyrocket. I know he said he was critically acclaimed, but I think he's so underestimated, and this is just the most enjoyable book I've read for a long time. And at the risk of having ordure hurled at me, I would say that I've actually enjoyed it more than the original. So I think it's Lawrence Osborne being just brilliant.
I mean, there's all sorts of things that come into that, about the idea of ventriloquizing a voice as opposed to kind of taking on a character and letting it breathe. There's some wisdom... maybe, John, you've got a line on this, in allowing Marlowe to get old, to have retired, to be living outside of the kind of that noirish Los Angeles which he operated in as a younger man, as a younger character.
Yeah, well, like Katie, I'm lost in admiration for what Osborne's done here. I'm not a massive fan of continuation novels. Not because, you know, some of them aren't good, some of them are excellent, but just it always feels a little bit lazy. But in fact, what we've got here is a book that I think isn't a continuation of Chandler. I think he's created a brilliant standalone novel. And the reason he doesn't fall into the usual problems, I mean, the Chandlerian voice, you know, we all know it. We know it from the Mitchum voiceovers. It's part of our cultural heritage. So,
and when everyone thinks of a noir detective, they think, whether they've read Chandler or not, whether they know Philip Marlowe or not, they're aping the voice of...
It's Mitchum or it's Bogart the guy who was in Farewell, My Lovely, whose name I forget, which is one of my favourite films. You know, the black pool opened and I fell in.
Yeah.
What Osborne does, he does 2 things that I think are very clever and that stop him falling into pastiche. One is he makes Marlowe old. He makes him 72. So it's as much a book about the perils and advantages of being old in a young person's world in the 80s. But he also sets it in Mexico, on the Mexican border. Osborne is a writer of place primarily, I think. He's peripatetic. He lives in Bangkok. His writing is all about delivering kind of realistic evocations of often quite exotic places. And he knows this world inside out. So he's taking Marlowe, I think somewhere in an interview he says, I couldn't do 50s Los Angeles because I've never been there, but I do know the Mexican border well. So you've immediately...
He's a journalist at that time, in that exact place, and that, so he plops him right into a time and a place he knows.
And he uses a lot of... I mean, there's some beautiful writing in this book, and we'll probably go over some of it later on, but he resists the simile, the bishop in the stained glass window, or my, you know, cutest lace pants, which is one that always comes into my... He resists that. I mean, there are some kind of Chandlerian zingers in there, but in general, what he does is he delivers a fully realised kind of seedy... you know, he knows the names of all the trees and the plants. He gives you that sort of sense of being... It's slightly unfamiliar, slightly exotic, slightly dangerous. It's a wonderful book.
And there's, it's a funny thing with a mystery novel. We think of Agatha Christie or things. There is something... The plot is such a locomotive that we have to get to the end. We want to know what happened and who done it, I suppose. With Chandler's Marlowe novels, the mystery was never the locomotive. It was always the character that was where the kind of action was, where the pleasure in reading was. Is that something that Osborne kind of keeps intact, if we all agree on that? That actually it's not a book about a mystery, it's a book about a man, about aging, about being in unfamiliar surroundings or back in the familiar surroundings of sleuthing. Is there any fairness in that, Katie?
I think there is. I think that I reread Farewell, My Lovely, and I found a lot of it actually really baffling. Mm. And some of the
plot-wise,
yeah. Some of the sentences, I actually thought reading it now, a lot of the language and cultural references are very outdated. Mm. And I think that this book is much more limpid, actually. I mean, there are certain, and without giving anything away, there are certain bafflements along the way, and you think, is that me, or is that a little bit unclear? And so one can suppose that is a nod to Chandler, that he's happy to do that, and he wanted to make it a bit dreamlike and a bit fantasy-like in places. But I think there's a real clarity and, as I say, a sort of limpidity to the language. And it's just beautifully done. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the continuation novels is how you do the language. Do you put in the period props? And I think one of the impressive things about this is that he's managed to set it in 1988. If you didn't know it was 1988 from the fact that it tells you that quite early on, I don't think you would necessarily know it was. It's not heavily 80s. I mean, there's a...
No,
it's a shoulder pad reference.
There's a shoulder pad and there's a Tina Turner.
The baffling music of Tina Turner.
Yes, which... and those were the only two things. But obviously there are no... You know, very often now when you get a sort of
It's not Stranger Things.
It's not Stranger Things, but nor is it a remake of sort of L.A. Confidential, where everybody's sort of chain smoking in a desperate bid to show that they're in the 1950s when smoking wasn't considered dangerous. He's absolutely managed to create this ageless atmosphere, and I think part of that is also because he's very good on the history of it. He's very interested in the history of a place and the ghosts. Previous ghosts of a place, so that it has this absolutely timeless quality to it.
Yeah, and I wanted, John sort of mentioned the place it's set. He leaves Baja California and goes down around the sort of border towns of Mexico and Southern California. Osborne's a great writer on frontiers as well. In fact, in a lot of his books, Hunters in the Dark is the one that's set in Cambodia and Vietnam and time. And there's a lot of murders that are committed over in one, or not a lot of murders, murders are committed on one side of the border and then people flee just over the other side and kind of are drinking, watching the river flow past, which is the natural border kind of thing. There's a bit of that in this as well. There's borders as fluid things, borders as a means of allowing you to change your suit and therefore your entire personality. There's a bit of that in this, John.
There is. In fact, I happened to watch Touch of Evil, the great Orson Welles film, which is also set in the Mexican border, where Welles plays this kind of corrupt cop. And I couldn't help feeling that Osborne just has that sort of nailed, that sense of... It's not that the cops are bad in this book, but there is the old kind of tension, which is pure Chandler, you know, the tension between the gumshoe and the cop. Yeah. And there's some nice scenes where he, towards the end, where he's kind of reliving. And this is where Osborne, he uses the word fairy tale. We were talking about my old cases, and my old cases seemed to me to be like fairy tales. And I knew that that had come from somewhere. And then I remember that's something that Chandler had actually used. You know, Marlowe was taken from Mallory in The Knight Errant, that he wanted to create. There's the famous story of for the adaptation, Howard Hawks' adaptation of The Big Sleep, that Faulkner is trying to figure out what happens to Owen Taylor, one of the minor characters. and he gets Hawks to ring Chandler and said, you know, how did he die? And Chandler just says, I can't remember. And I think there's a lovely sense that Osborne knows the kind of, the interesting thing, Osborne
knows the vagueness of it and the dreamlike quality.
But
I
feel that there's a kind of connection that Chandler started writing in his mid to late 40s. His novels before that, he'd worked, I think, insurance or.
And he was an ad man.
Yeah. And Osborne was a journalist and came back to writing fiction in his early 50s. So you do feel that he's kind of well versed in Chandler lore. Hmm. And he says, I think, in his acknowledgement that he's a writer that he'd loved all his life. So that only makes the achievement more remarkable, I think. You could really pick up this book and not know anything about Raymond Chandler.
I agree.
And find it completely gripping. Well, we've got one issue, haven't we, Katie, about the plotting that we
well, that's the thing. I wanted to. My next question was going to be about that. Was going to be about the dreamlike attitude of some of it, the kind of fugue state that maybe the novelist is in, or maybe his character is in, or maybe both, and whether that allows for a plot that isn't watertight, and whether or not it matters. We wondered slightly about the ending of this, but yes. maybe that was done on purpose.
Well, Osborne writes at the end that he has this little quote from a letter that Chandler wrote to his friend Maurice Guinness, and he quotes it in his acknowledgement, saying, "I see Marlowe in a lonely street, in lonely rooms, puzzled but never quite defeated."
Yeah.
And so I think it is that air of puzzlement, and I wondered at the end, ooh, have I missed something? And actually, I wasn't sure whether I had or not. And my response was that I would like to go back and reread the book.
Yeah.
And it's quite short. And I think the language is so delicious. It's not often that you feel that you're wading through golden syrup when you read some of his prose. I think this is his other great achievement that I found. The reading of the sentences just in themselves so pleasurable. And if we had time, I was going to.
Yeah, no, we've got to hear some of this stuff. We've lauded it, but it's very satisfying to read.
As John said, I think one of Osborne's great strengths as a writer is his ability to evoke place. And in all the novels of his I've read, his evocations of place, descriptive of the atmosphere, the temperature, the people, and just the history of the place comes across. And here's just a short paragraph I'm going to read. And in a sense, I would say it doesn't matter where it is or what's going on. And that's the point. It's just the language. The trees were filled with rags that rattled in the wind like Buddhist prayer flags. And the graves were turned a faint blue by the fragments of blossom clinging desperately to the branches. Tombs of archangels and celestial creatures blowing trumpets, but with a hidden strain of Aztec terror. No wonder the French had shriveled up here and turned into mummies. A dust-dry wind swept through it, stirring the plastic rags, and the blue petals were whipped up into little pretty tornadoes and then dumped back on the surface of the tombs. She had chosen her spot well.
Oh, it's great.
It's really great.
It's violent, and it's you can smell it and see it, and there's a frisson of terror there. It's just brilliant, I think.
I'm just going to do a quick bit. Marlowe's gone back to the hotel and he's loaded. At the hotel I fell into bed and lay there fully clothed, full of demonic premonitions. It sometimes happened when I went back to the booze. And I went back to it as soon as I was alone in America and not with my housekeeper and regulars in Mexico. It was as if the lights went out, and in the darkness I crawled about, secretly delighted and ravished. Drinkers never learn the antidote. Our way of surviving is just to succumb once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
It could easily be Chandler, but it's also pure Lawrence Osborne.
Yes, you know, yeah.
His great book on drinking, The Wet and the Dry, is full of that kind of... No, why do we keep doing it?
Yeah.
I know I've got a problem. Why don't I just stop?
And that's the thing. So that both of those passages you read feel like a perfect, whether it's the character in the novel or it's the character of the novelist that's being copied in a way, are in perfect sort of harmony. It's a tough thing to pick who to continue on. You know, Anthony Horowitz as Ian Fleming. I think Sebastian Faulks did a Bond novel as well.
William Boyd,
Amos. Yeah. And I wonder how are these chosen, I wonder. Do we have any inkling? I mean, there's obviously, it's good to have a name as writing as somebody else. But I wonder if it's a sort of fandom, I mean, and a sort of way of, I don't know.
Katie, I think, knows more, but I'm guessing it's estates who are kind of looking of ways, I mean, brutally, of monetizing their asset.
Yeah.
And apparently they do. And there are, you know, there are people within the publishing firms, the big publishing firms that look after the estates and will, you know, suggest people. And I think what's interesting is that the authors who do these continuation novels find that if they work well, their own sales for their own books are hugely boosted. But of course, this also makes a lot of money for the estates. And, you know, you could look at it as a bit of a cynical operation by the estates to make money. But, you know, my view is that...
But when it's done so well as this,
that all just disappears. The bottom line is the continuation novel is only as good as the writer writing it.
Yeah.
And some of the people you've mentioned are much better writers than others.
Yeah.
And some of the continuation novels have worked much better than others. But I go back to your original question about whether he's, you know, Osborne or Chandler. This is a really good Osborne book.
Yeah, as John was saying, there's such a sort of sympathy of place, maybe of writing about drink so well.
He makes smart aesthetic choices. Yeah. He doesn't try and go back to Los Angeles. I mean, it's an interesting one, the continuation novel. I mean, that part of me always thinks that all literature, you know, without getting too Harold Bloom and anxiety of influence on it, but all literature is sort of people rewriting great books. And it's interesting to me, I think the ones that tend to work better are the genre writers. So it's easier to do a Bond than it is to do Jane Austen or Dickens.
Yeah, you're right. There is something about the definite voice, I suppose, of it. The kind of and the leitmotifs that you can follow, for sure. I wanted to talk a little bit, before we talk about what this book made us think of, some extra reading, about Dolores, who's the girl in the book, the inevitable girl, you might say, in the book. Who he's got, as I say, one as John says, one of the sort of Chandlerian zingers is devoted to her, or a couple of them are. But it becomes he falls for her, but he realizes he's also, without wanting to spoil the plot, he realizes he's a man of advanced years and all the rest of it. And it seems at the end he follows her for pure pleasure, which is one of these kind of fugue-like states of the book, which is so beautiful, which I think is where the excerpt that you read, Katie, came from as well. What do we think about that? I found that very satisfying that there wasn't any kind of sexual clumsiness necessarily in this.
Oh, that was such a relief. Right. It was such a relief.
There were moments when you think, no.
Don't put it away. I thought what was really good about that was that I think she's about 30 or something, and she's very vividly described. And he falls for her, but he realises in the moments that he's looking at her and sort of lusting after her, that he doesn't stand a hope in hell. He's not even going to go there.
Yeah.
And yet, and I think that's another thing that you've said, John, about how well Osborne handles the questions of mortality and ageing. You know, there he is at 72. The old dog hasn't quite died yet. You know, the old dog's up.
But he's not going to make a fool of himself. And it's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
It's very tenderly done.
The meditations on aging and getting older. Instead, he has kind of I'm sure this is a Osborne classic phallic symbol. He has this samurai.
Oh, it's
samurai
so
cane, which and you know Osborne's sort of big on Japan, and it enables him to have a digression on the on the quality of the blade and how it's made.
The thing about the cane. Early on, he mentions the Zatoichi films that he'd watched in the 60s. So I thought, I wonder what that is. And I said, have a quick look on YouTube. And it is, of course, he's a blind man who is an absolute whiz with this spear. This turns out to be completely sort of fabulous. You know, you look at him and you think, there's some blind old duffer. And then he turns into sort of kill all the sort of samurai on the spot.
There's some lovely references in it. I fear that we might have cooked our goose in terms of time, as far as Only to Sleep's concerned. But I wanted to talk about what this reminded you both of, Katie, in terms of sort of the masculine voice and maybe some of the territory, the geography, I should say, of the book. It reminded you of Cormac McCarthy.
It did.
Talk us through this a little
bit. It did. So I thought, yes, I know it's, you know, you say it's Patricia Highsmith or Paul Bowles or, you know...
These are all the people that Osborne's compared to.
And so I was thinking about this, and as I was reading it, I thought this is so distinctively masculine and it's so idiosyncratic a voice. And it's not quite like anything else. And then I thought, actually, it reminds me of Cormac McCarthy, and in particular, No Country for Old Men. And then, as I was reading, there's a point at which this Topper character says to Marlowe, "This is a fine country for old men." And he's actually talking about Mexico and rather than Texas, which is where No Country for Old Men is set. But then I went back to No Country for Old Men and the Cormac McCarthy version, not the film version. But they are, in fact, remarkably and brilliantly similar. And it is such rewarding reading. And there are some very similar scenes. And there's another scene where, again, without spoiling it, it's all about chasing the money. I mean, both of these stories are about chasing the money, and they're sort of cat and mouse, and they're crossing borders, and
there's some sort of seedy hotel room
scenes.
Seedy hotel room scenes,
and there are in both books. There's a similar seedy hotel scene, and one person is coming to kill another person, and to track the money down and to kill a person, and the other person knows it. It is absolutely cat and mouse. And so I feel certain that Osborne was making a bit of a nod to that. And then I found myself rereading Cormac McCarthy and thinking, you know, the aging, the sheriff in this case, you know, the reflective inner voice reflecting on his life, on his past, on the crimes he's committed, on the deaths he's witnessed and so on. And I think there's, again, there's this wonderful, wonderful idiosyncratic use of language. So I would just commend anyone who hasn't ever read Cormac McCarthy to try.
And that's a great place to start.
And that would be a wonderful place to start. Yeah.
And also the sort of relentlessness of the weather and the topography in that part of the world, in northern Texas and southern California, the 100-degree heat, you know, the 100 miles between gas stations. Accidentally, I read this when I was on a road trip and ended up in some of the country for No Country for Old Men country, in like Valentine in Texas and places like this, where they filmed it. And it was strange. I mean, I'd certainly double-locked the motel room door when I was reading this.
Because there was something
particularly dusty and unrelenting about it. Beautifully described by Osborne, beautifully read by yourself, Katie, in describing some of the places. But kind of desolate, extra desolate at midday and at midnight, I suppose, when there's either only the light of the moon and the kind of sort of high noon as well.
High noon.
It's tough. It's strong stuff. John, this reminded you of a couple of people. You wanted to talk about Jean Rhys.
Jean Rhys suddenly came to me. I was thinking about continuation novels and the ones that have been successful. And I think the greatest of them all is White Sargasso Sea, which is Jean Rhys's the novel that brought her back really into public prominence in the late 60s when she was in her late 70s. And it is the story of the mad wife in the attic from Jane Eyre, who is Creole. And it's an act of extraordinary reinvention. But it wasn't that Jean Rhys that I was thinking. It's the pre-war Jean Rhys, the Jean Rhys of the Paris novels, which are essentially all a series of books about young women living in disreputable circumstances, bad jobs, missed meals, booze like haze, failed relationships, which she writes brilliantly about. And it suddenly struck me that that single voice, although we think of it as very male, I kind of went back to Good Morning Midnight, and started to notice how Chandlerian her voice is. Mm. It's like Jean Rhys is like Philip Marlowe without any MacGuffin at all. There's no real need for a plot. But she's brilliant at that sort of that sense of a mind, that existential kind of chewing over of emotional experience.
Being in a hotel room, puzzled and alone, but not bereft.
And that's exactly that line also came back to me. There's just, this could be Chandler. You know, you are walking along a road peacefully. You trip, you fall into blackness. That's the past, or perhaps the future. And you know that there is no past, no future. There is only this blackness, changing faintly, slowly, but always the same. Yeah. You know, that's Marlowe in a hotel room reflecting on his case.
Yeah.
So it's just a curious thing. I'm pretty sure that Osborne is a Jean Rhys fan. The other thing I think that I felt was that both Chandler and Osborne, Jean Rhys, these are writers that often get pulled in to be politicised. You know, Osborne writes really wonderfully about his early lefty kind of days and how becoming a novelist has changed that for him. Chandler was always, you know, Dashiell Hammett was obviously very left-wing, Chandler was much more difficult. It's that kind of existential. They're much more Camus than they are Sartre, you know. And that, I think, makes them better novelists. So, I mean, it's an odd leap to make. But I would, I definitely think Jean Rhys is an interesting writer to read in both connection to Chandler, but certainly to Osborne. I think he's, and nobody writes better about the effect of drink than Jean Rhys. She's brilliant.
And that kind of brings us back to the idea of the voice and about how you do period without being dated. And I know both of you, that was something that you flagged up before we switched on the microphones, Katie. How is that, as John says with Jean Rhys and that kind of particular voice, you almost don't need a plot. You just want to read people's reflections on being alive and being sleepless, being drunk, kind of muddling through life somehow. How has Osborne just finally, do you think, kind of achieved those period details, wearing his kind of learning lightly and not sort of being a ventriloquist, I suppose?
Well, I think that he's done it in two ways. And the first is that he has purposefully omitted the period details. You know, the things that make us aware of specific time and place, you know, Wi-Fi routers or mobile phones, yeah. or transistor radios or all those things. And I think that those can be done in a very heavy-handed way, often both in movies and in books, to try and evoke a particular period. And he's completely avoided all of that. So in a sense, it could have been at any time. It could have been in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or, in fact, in the 80s. Because he just doesn't go there with any of that stuff. And he just manages to create a place that has links with its past. And he will talk about the history of a place. But he weaves it through in this very, very, very light way. You know, as you saw from the piece I read out, you know, no wonder the French sort of shriveled up and turned into mummies.
There's something timelessness.
It's completely timeless.
It's light on a glass, the taste of the first drink of the day on your tongue.
I mean, there's the gimlet. The gimlet has a big walk-on part.
The rose is cordial.
I mean, A.L. Kennedy said that Jean Rhys had an indecent appetite for detail, and I think Osborne's the same. You know, there is that sense that it's not about the brand names. It's about the kind of those eternal little bits of consciousness that a great writer can put into a plot and not make it feel like it's a distraction.
Oh, it's wonderful stuff. Well, thank you both very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Only to Sleep by Lawrence Osborne is out now, published by Hogarth. Thank you to my guests, Katie Law and John Mitchinson, and to my producer, Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time next week. We'll be on slightly different turf. We'll be at the theatre for the stage production of Michael Lehman's 1988 dark teen comedy, Heathers. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound, John Mitchinson's laughing, thank you very much for tuning in.